Good morning. I'd like to bring a call the meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee to order. It's Thursday, March 7th, 2024, and we do have a quorum present. We are going to switch the order just a little bit. I'm going to present the bill that I have on the agenda first, and then we will move to Senator Fatte. So I will move to the table.
Madam Chair, when you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm presenting Senate File 4570 this morning, and this is a bill that was brought to us by the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. This is a bill that would create a guest license, which may be granted upon application to a licensed marriage and family therapist who has a license in another jurisdiction but wishes to practice in Minnesota, either in person or via telehealth, for a limited period. Once this license is issued, the guest license is valid for 1 year with practice by the LMFT, limited to no more than 5 consecutive months. This is a bill that would bring the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy in line with its Behavioral Health Regulatory Board counterparts. The MFT bill is modeled after the Minnesota Board of Psychology's guest licensure statute, and the Minnesota Board of Social Work also has a temporary license statute. The Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy has a statutory provision allowing for temporary practice by a non-resident licensed clinical counselor as well. There are certain criteria that the person would need to meet. The guest licensure applicant would be required to verify holding the LMFT license in another jurisdiction. They may not be subject to any current disciplinary orders or complaint investigations. They'd be required to complete a fingerprint-based criminal background check and pay the guest license fee of $150. The license would not be would be a non-renewable license, but the LMFT would be able to again apply for a guest license upon expiration of the prior 1 year guest license. A guest license is intended to increase access to qualified, competent marriage and family therapy services for Minnesotans by allowing those holding the LMFT license in another jurisdiction to provide MFT services for a limited period. So individuals who would be anticipated to receive services from a guest licensed LMFT may include college students at home for summer or school year breaks, people who are temporarily located in Minnesota for work or family reasons, or individuals who have permanently relocated to Minnesota while they transition from a prior LMFT to a Minnesota licensed mental health professional. So that is the what the bill does. We do have the executive director, Jennifer Mollenhoff, is on Zoom if there are any questions or if she'd like to provide any additional information. But otherwise, I would stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Senator Ecky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wicklund, can you touched on it just a little bit, but can you give us a further examples of where this would be used or how it would be used? The fact that they're only coming here temporarily, is it a need that we've been missing? I guess I'm just looking for a little more detail.
Sure, I think Ms. Mollenhoff probably would be able to give more detailed information. My understanding is that there are cases where a provider would like to be able to practice in Minnesota, but not get a total, you know, a new license here, but they would like to do it just for a limited period of time. But maybe Ms. Mollenhoff could also provide some examples.
Ms. Mollenhoff, if you introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I'm Jennifer Mollenhoff, Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Utke. The inquiries we receive now on a regular basis do primarily fall into the big picture categories that Chair Wicklund mentioned, which are students, primarily college students, either home for breaks or home for the summer, who've established regular behavioral health care in another jurisdiction where they're going to school or where they're residing primarily 9 months of the year while they're college students. People coming to Minnesota for periods of time, perhaps again the summer, to take in lengthy vacations or summer trips like that, or care for parents. We see that a lot. Or we see people who kind of the snowbird phenomenon where they're in Minnesota for an extended period of time. And then the other primary one we receive are people relocating to Minnesota permanently, but they have an established therapeutic relationship with a therapist in another state and intend to transition to a Minnesota licensed provider because they're now going to be a Minnesota resident. But that takes time to find qualified care and available care. So this would allow, it's primarily a continuity of care issue that would allow people to continue to see a licensed marriage and family therapist without, you know, experiencing disruption to that care.
Thank you, Ms. Mollenhoff. Senator Rucki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might be dense, but I'm not connecting the dots yet on this because I hear about the people coming in that would be receiving the therapy, and this is a license for the therapist. It seems to be the two different sides. I mean, so that's what my question was. If you are that therapist that's coming into the state just temporarily, that's what, you know, kind of looking for what need or what, you know, what have we been missing or what do we anticipate?
Madam Chair, if I'm not mistaken, it's you can't provide care to someone in Minnesota unless you have a Minnesota license. So that's why the therapist needs that temporary license while the patient comes into Minnesota temporarily. Does that make sense?
Well, that's what I've been kind of going after is because to me, even the last testifier was talking more about the people that come to Minnesota and then are receiving therapy. But this is for the license, for the temporary license for the therapist. That's what I'm wondering is, I'm hearing about those needing the service, but this is the other side of it.
Madam Chair, Senator Utke, I think it sounds like to me, if a college student establishes a relationship with a therapist in, say, Arizona, and they are going to school there, but they are from Minnesota and they're going to come back here for the summer break, they would not be able to continue care with that therapist by telehealth or other means unless that therapist gets a permanent or this guest licensure so that they would be able to practice. And it could be by telehealth or in person. But otherwise, that student would come home, they would have to establish a relationship with another therapist here in Minnesota, and then they would have to, if they went back to school, then they would be going back to that therapist, which my understanding is that is not a good continuity of care and not something that necessarily people would desire, although it wouldn't be impossible for them to do that. So that would be an example I could see.
Senator Rucki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that makes sense. It's for the therapists. It's practicing from outside our borders and helping people that are here in Minnesota. And I was thinking these therapists were going to be providing the service within our borders. So that makes sense. Thank you.
Members, other questions? Seeing none. Senator Wicklund, would you like to make a motion that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee of State Government?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be my motion.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The bill is referred. Moved, passed.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Senate File 4235. Senator Fata, if you could come forward, and whenever you're...
Sorry.
Good morning, Senator Fata. Welcome to the committee, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present SF 4235. As we welcome an increasingly diverse workforce in long-term care, we should lower barriers to working in this field. SF 4235 does two things. Section 1 requires MDH to provide language accommodation for applicants who want to take the written portion of the certified nursing assistant exam. To be on the registry, applicants must take both a written exam and a skills exam. Unfortunately, the written exam is only available in English. Section 2 of the bill would expand where foreign trained nurses can be trained to become a trained medication aide. Under Minnesota laws and rules, training is only available through higher education institutions like technical colleges and universities. This bill would allow other programs to be approved by MDH, which would greatly expand access to this training and is modeled after the successful efforts to expand CNA training. Not every learner is able to go to a college, and these programs aren't always available at convenient times or locations. This bill would not change the TMA scope of practice. It simply expands access to TMA training and is an important workforce solution. I have two people here who would like to testify on behalf of the bill and others available for questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. And so I have a couple names of people listed on Zoom, but would you like to do these, your in-person testifiers first, or would you like
us to go on Zoom?
Yeah. Okay. First, I have Johanna Keg, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, honorable members of the community. My name is Johanna Keg, and I'm here to testify in support of the Senate File 4235. I currently reside in Alexandria, Minnesota, and work throughout the Lone Prairie area to support a vibrant Spanish-speaking community by providing career support and coordinating their access to health care services. Senate File 4235 is crucial to communities like ours. There are many communities across Minnesota facing language barriers to both accessing healthcare and establishing livable wage jobs. I work directly with both elders in the community who are unable to find caregivers who speak their language and with individuals who are seeking to enter this workforce. Senate File 4235 provides meaningful pathways to address both of these crucial issues, enhancing employment opportunities outside of the manufacturing sector. Is essential to developing a holistic and thriving community. Allowing individuals to complete the exam in their preferred language will demonstrate their competency in providing care while honoring the importance of one's linguistic heritage, preserving traditional languages, and fostering pride and respect for linguistic diversity within our communities. A recent survey of long-term care providers found that 21% of providers have experienced a delay in onboarding a prospective hire due to the written portion of the exam, when we have 17,000 positions across the state that are open, including at least 3,000 CNA positions specifically. This is something we must address. They are Minnesotans, they are family members, there are members of our community who have earned the right to care. In conclusion, Senate File 4235 is a crucial step towards removing language barriers and increasing access and opportunity in the long-term care sector. By allowing individuals to complete exams in their preferred language, we can honor the importance of linguistic heritage, preserve traditional languages, and foster pride and respect for linguistic diversity within our community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I have Bobby Coons. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Bobby Coons, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to testify in support for the Senate file 4235 as well. In my work as a clinical nurse educator with Ecumen, I see that expanding access to medication aid training as a workforce solution that is desperately needed as we continue to find new ways to adapt to a prolonged workforce crisis. And we want to ensure that foreign trained nurses have the same opportunity as others seeking this certification. Advancing this education offering is certainly something that our organization would explore offering. We know that medication aides can play a vital role in the distribution of work amongst the care team. Working under a registered nurse, they can offset some of the medication dispensation tasks. Trained medication aid is an achievable step in the clinical career ladder for nursing assistants. With some additional training and competency verification, they can both expand their skill set and contribute to resident health and well-being in new ways while advancing their opportunities in this profession. Our facility is looking for training that fits the learning style of our workforce and is readily accessible to our workforce based on their schedule and needs. We support this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Those at the table, are you there for questions or? Okay,
yeah.
Great. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? No questions? Senator Kupek? Okay, you can make a comment. Senator Kupek?
Sorry, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, Senator Abel, I've been sitting next to you too long, maybe. You're wearing off on me. I think we talked a little bit about this yesterday. This is a couple days ago in committee too, when we have this workforce that's here in Minnesota and we're not utilizing them to the greatest ability, and this is just another bill that kind of does that and moves that forward. So I'm happy that we're here in this bill in committee, and thank you, Senator Fathe.
Any other questions? Well, I don't see any other questions. I do think that it does seem like a really helpful bill if people have better access to training and they can get advanced in their positions. It seems like that's helpful for Minnesota and helpful for the locations that really need workers right now. So, Senator Fathe, any other comments?
No, I just want to say thank you so much for allowing us to present this bill, and I want to thank the folks here and the testifiers on Zoom as well. So, thank you.
Thank you. And so, Senator Mann moves that Senate File 4235 is recommended, or excuse me, we are just laying this bill over. I'm thinking all the other bills today, actually, we don't need to have Senator Mann make that motion. I can just say Senate File 4235 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we will go to Senator Abler. Senate File 3984, Behavioral Science Health Licensing and Eligibility Requirements Modifications.
Yep.
And this bill has a lot of other sections that don't relate to our committee, but we will be recommending that this be referred to Human Services for kind of a full discussion of those sections of the bill.
But that's a worthy recommendation, Madam Chair. So,
please go ahead and present your bill.
Yeah, thank you very much. And so Senate File 3984 has to do with the March, which they will describe this. I'm not going to be very lengthy here, except to point out the need to handle substance abuse and so on is just a big deal. We try and try and try, and it's like a marathon, and like you're walking to Florida. You make progress, and I just want to call attention to the last section of the bill. There has been effort at simplification of paperwork, which I think we're trying to walk to Cuba on some of that. There's actually paperwork describing how we're going to be reducing the paperwork. So beyond that, Madam Chair, I'll just turn it over to my testifiers who can get right to the point of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. And I have Dr. Georgia Jameson. Please state your name, who's testifying for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Zerbis. I'm the Executive Director of MARCH. I'm going to provide a brief overview of sections 2 through 6 and then pass it off to Dr. Georgia for the testimony relevant to this committee. So as Senator Abler had mentioned, this policy bill was developed by MARCH membership, which is comprised of both programs and professionals throughout Minnesota. Section 2 is the alternative licensing inspections. What this language would do is to expand to include 2 national certification bodies for programs to be eligible for alternative licensing inspections in Minnesota. Section 3 is a change to align Minnesota standards with American Society of Addiction Medicine. Specifically, it would look to remove the term licensing candidates from a ratio that programs have to maintain. Section 4 is regarding the Behavioral Health Fund affidavit. So there's 2 parts to this one, which shorten the timeline that counties would have to enroll or determine eligibility for someone for the Behavioral Health Fund, and then also to only use the Behavioral Health Fund affidavit as eligibility, which is DHS Form 2780A. Section 5 has additional components aligning Minnesota standards with American Society of Addiction Medicine standards. It would be reducing ratio or hours for medical services, having a mental health professional be programs that they employ a mental health professional, not go by a 25% ratio, have engagement and documentation requirements for people in residential programs, and have counselors have holiday hours off in those programs. Lastly, Senator Abler touched on this a little bit, but there's a paperwork reduction report that has a due date that we're hoping to have the due date moved up, which is after the vendor's contract ends, but before the 2-year window that it would be released in September of 2025. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And now, Dr. Jameson, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Georgia Jameson. I'm a professor at the Hazel and Betty Ford Graduate School. We are proposing in the bill that we add language to extend the requirements for the LADC, licensed alcohol and drug counselor, that can be bachelor's or master's. Currently, it states just bachelor's. And we have a small little loophole where we have some students coming through that don't have a bachelor's degree, but they're going to be getting a master's degree in counseling with an addiction focus. Currently, because the bill states explicitly it must be a bachelor's degree, our students who have these master's degrees will not be able to get licensed as alcohol and drug counselors.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? And Senator Abler, if there are questions about any part of the bill, feel free. I mean, this is the committee of origin for the bill, and so I'm not limiting questions to that section. I just wanted to point out that the bill is going to go to Human Services, so there will be a full discussion about the other sections. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, just for context, I just have maybe Mr. Zerbis. You know, some people know who MARCH is. MARCH is just a highly well thought of organization of people involved in just combating this horrible problem. Did you know how many, offhand, I just didn't prepare for this question, but how many like counselors and workers and people are involved under your umbrella? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Zerbis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Senator Abler's question, the scope of all treatment programs in Minnesota, as of a few days ago, there's 417 active licenses. For March membership, we have a little over 60 organizations that represent roughly 2/3 of those licensed programs. And then so within that in Minnesota, there's, I think the last I recollection is about 6,500 licensed alcohol and drug counselors. So again, roughly 2/3 of those would be members or part of member agencies.
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Able?
Just to give a feel for it, it's ironic we have to, I mean, go from bachelor to master's. To, sorry, you haven't got a lot. The minutia we have to contend with and some of this stuff is amazing. I think the most ironic is the last testimony that you have a master's. I'm sorry, the law doesn't allow that. If you want to just give that back and only have a bachelor's, then you, so it's, here we are, but it's, I really enjoyed working with them. They're highly credible. They're so engaged and focused, and it's a good bill, and so I'm happy to be carrying it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Senator Abler. It seems like a pretty common sense change that we can make, so hopefully it will add the flexibility that's needed. So if there aren't any other comments, did you have any other final comments about the bill?
No, I'll just make the thanks for the attention, and we'll, you know, this will make it a little bit easier to rescue some of these folks from the abyss, frankly, as they just fight their daily challenges. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'd like to move that Senate File 3984 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Human Services.
On Senator Abler's motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 3984 is recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Human Services.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And next we will move to Senator Morrison, Senate File 3531. Welcome, Senator Morrison, to present your bill. I do see an A2 amendment. Did you want to adopt that as an author's amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would offer the, is it the A2 or the A1?
I have the A2. Is that, yeah. That's what's in our packet.
Okay.
Oh, there was an A1 amendment, but the there was an incorrect date.
Thank you.
Or Ms. Did you do it this, Mr. Hodala? Okay. Maybe you can just tell
us. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The A2 amendment is exactly the same as the A1 with one slight correction. It updates an effective date from 2024 to 2025. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Council.
Senator Morrison moves that the A2 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does pass, and the A2 amendment is adopted. Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3531 as amended. Members, our physicians are in trouble. Burnout for healthcare professionals is a real problem that is getting worse. 6 in 10 physicians have felt inappropriate feelings of anger, tearfulness, or anxiety, classic symptoms of burnout. 1/3 have felt hopeless or that they have no purpose. And more than half know a physician who has considered, attempted, or died by suicide. More than half. The entire healthcare team is strained, but we don't talk about our doctors much. We kind of assume they're fine. And that reflects the way many of us were trained. We're tough, we work hard, long hours. We care for people who are suffering in pain, impacted by society's inequities. And that's not a complaint. Doctors knew what they were signing up for. We knew we'd spend more than a decade of our lives studying, learning, training to have the honor of taking care of patients. We expect perfection of ourselves, and when we fall short of that impossible standard, as humans inevitably do, we're expected to move on. But patients are more medically complex. Bureaucratic responsibilities and frustration have grown exponentially. But there remains a stigma around reaching out for help. That same survey that I referenced shows that 80% of physicians agree that there does remain a stigma surrounding seeking mental health treatment. And 40% said they were afraid to get treatment because they would have to report it on future credentialing applications. Senate File 3531 is a small bill that tries to address just some of those issues. The bill does four main things. It prohibits insurers, hospitals, and employers from asking about past health conditions that have nothing to do with their ability to practice medicine. These questions discourage physicians and other professionals from getting care when they need it. Those entities can and must ask about current conditions that impact the person's ability to practice medicine. Number two, it establishes a new health professional well-being recognition program that will recognize hospitals, clinics, and health systems that are doing a good job in addressing clinician well-being. By recognizing those that are doing well, we can all learn the best practices and effective approaches for optimal well-being practices. Third, it provides limited protection for physicians who participate in the Safe Haven program. Safe Haven is a program created by the Virginia Medical Society that provides services to physicians to address work-life balance, including counseling services. The Minnesota Medical Association is offering this program to physicians, but many are hesitant to participate because of the fear that their participation will be shared with the licensing board. Similar protections have passed in Arizona, Virginia, South Dakota, and other states. And lastly, Section 4 is a one-time appropriation for an awareness education campaign focused on reducing the stigma on getting needed mental health treatment. Will these steps eliminate burnout among doctors? No. But they are based on recommendations from the MMA's well-being task force, comprised of well-being experts from Minnesota's health systems. They will go a long way to remove barriers to care, remove stigma, and promote clinician well-being through our healthcare systems. This will help our physicians stay in the workforce and continue to take excellent care of our patients. With that, I will turn it over to our testifier, who I'm very grateful is here with us today.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Michelle Chestovich. I'm a family physician, and I'm testifying today on behalf of more than the 10,000 members of the Minnesota Medical Association in strong support of Senate File 3531. Physician burnout is real. According to a survey conducted by the AMA, Mayo Clinic, and Stanford University School of Medicine, 62.8% of physicians report having at least one manifestation of burnout in 2021. It has gotten worse since the pandemic. Burnout has many causes: lack of staffing, interferences from insurers and PBMs on practice decisions, the growing lack of trust in science. There is no one solution to the problem, but we must start to address it. The beginnings of burnout start early in the training of our future physicians. A survey from the Physicians Foundation in 2023 found that 55% of medical students felt hopeless. According to the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, physicians have one of the highest suicide rates of any profession. More than half of physicians know a physician who has either considered, attempted, or died by suicide in their career. One-fifth of physicians and residents and a quarter of medical students know a colleague or peer who has considered suicide in the past year. It is estimated that 1 million Americans lose their physician to suicide every year. These statistics are startling, but I want to share they are also personal. My younger sister died by suicide on March 5th, 2021. Dr. Gretchen Butler was an amazing and incredible woman. She was a beloved radiologist at Hennepin County Medical Center. She was a mother of three young children. She had a loving and supportive family. Burnout and sleep deprivation contributed to her death. As physicians, we are not always the best patients. We are trained to be problem solvers. We are trained to keep working even when we're exhausted. We are not well trained in how to care for ourselves. One reason physicians don't seek treatment is the fear that this treatment will be reported on future credentialing and employment applications. This fear is real. SF 3531 will prohibit the need to report that you have received treatment in the past. Many hospitals and clinics are beginning to address physician well-being, but the work is not universal. SF 3531 creates a recognition program to publicize systems that are doing a good job so we can learn and improve on these well-being systems programs. We have a healthcare workforce shortage problem in Minnesota. And while solutions usually look at how to get more students in the training pipeline, we also need to look and ensure that those who are practicing remain healthy and fully engaged. Please support SF 3531 as a major step forward to address physician well-being. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm very sorry for your loss. Thank you for highlighting the needs for this bill. So, thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, just a brief comment. Thank you, Senator Morrison, for bringing this bill. Thank you for your testimony. I'm very sorry for your loss, but thank you for being here to share your story. There are many physicians in my district, and many of them have come to me and told me about this very issue, and I certainly experienced that in my professional work as well. Pressures on physicians are great, certainly, and so making sure that we are doing all we can to prevent burnout and make it easier for physicians to get the care that they need is absolutely what we should be doing. In my community, we have experienced the death of more than one physician by suicide. And so anything we can do to prevent that, we should be doing. I especially appreciate the first section around the prohibited application questions, making sure that folks are able to get care and not have to worry that that is going to be a threat to their license is certainly an important step. So thank you very much for bringing this bill. I'm glad to see it move forward.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Senator Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to our testifier. And to Dr. Morrison. I made a social media post a couple years ago on Physician Suicide Awareness Day, and people thought that I was suicidal because I wanted to bring attention to this issue. I just want to read you an excerpt of it because this is what life of a doctor is like, and people don't know this because we don't talk about it, right? So you train over 10 years, you essentially give up your 20s while you watch all of your friends live their lives. You spend hours upon hours reading and testing, you compare yourself to everyone in your class, you feel less than when you get 95%. You graduate drowning in debt, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. You live under the heavy, unforgiving hand of pressure. Pressure to never fail, pressure to never make a mistake, pressure to know exactly how to handle any and all situations and emergencies at all times. Never make a mistake. You put on your scrubs and your white coat and you hide your dark circles. You deny your anxiety and your insomnia. You don't tell anyone because that would make you weak. You don't tell anyone that you cried with or for a patient because that makes you weak and that makes you emotional if you're a woman. If you show your weakness, then you're a liability. If you are a liability, then your livelihood and your children's future are on the line. So you don't tell anyone because you are a physician. You are not human. This is not just me, right? This is what physicians feel like all the time. So to bring a bill to highlight that, to bring awareness, to make it so that we can talk about how hard this job is incredibly amazing, and I thank you both for doing that and for your courage to tell your story. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Morrison, any final comments that you'd like to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm grateful to the committee for considering this effort. Very grateful to my doctor colleague for sharing her story. And also, thank you for your words, Dr. Mann.
Thank you. I appreciate your bringing forward, and I appreciate the having the specific items that we can do to, you know, that we can try to move forward and take action on this issue. So thank you. This bill needs to go to the Judiciary Committee. So Senator Morrison, your motion would be to recommend that Senate File 3531 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 3531, as amended, is passed and referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, members, we have Senate File 2846, Senator May Quaid. Welcome to the committee, Senator May Quaid. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I believe there is an author's amendment.
There is.
And members, Senator Mann moves that the A1 amendment be adopted. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Please proceed and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was very moving testimony on the previous bill, so bear with me as I just collect myself, and thank you, Senator Mann, for your words. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Before you today is Senate File 2846, which would prohibit health professionals or students or residents from who are participating in a course of instruction for performing sensitive exams on unconscious or anesthetized patients without informed consent. For the purposes of this bill, a sensitive examination is a pelvic, breast, urogenital, or rectal exam, and there are, of course, exceptions in this if a person needs a diagnostic exam or treatment while they're unconscious or anesthetized, or for the purposes of collecting evidence. And it also just requires informed consent to be given if you're okay with someone doing this when you're unconscious or under anesthesia. This bill came to me actually from an individual, from someone that I know. And after I introduced this bill, I learned that many other states have passed similar laws. I'm really appreciative of both the advice and counsel of my colleagues who work in the healthcare field, the bipartisan support for this bill, and also the input of the University of Minnesota Medical School. They have a policy that is really similar to this bill that we kind of modeled it after. So I'm just really grateful that we have proactive folks here in the state of Minnesota, and I think there are folks out in our state who would feel a lot more comforted to know that the policies we have for our good providers and trainers is the law as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have one testifier on Zoom, Molly Montague. If you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Molly Montague, and I am here on behalf of the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, also known as RAIN. RAIN is the nation's largest anti-sexual assault organization. Founded in 1994, RAIN created and operates the National Sexual Assault Hotline and carries out programs to support victims. The issue of involuntary pelvic exams came to our attention as survivors reported it. We are here today in support of SF-2846, which would ensure that patients provide informed consent before healthcare providers or medical students supervised by providers perform intimate exams on a patient while they are anesthetized or unconscious. This bill is necessary to ensure patients in Minnesota, especially survivors of sexual violence, are not re-traumatized by invasive examinations that are conducted without their consent for purposes that are not medically necessary. A study of medical students from 7 American medical schools showed that 61% of respondents who had performed a pelvic exam on an anesthetized patient reported doing so without the patient's explicit consent. This is confirmed by a separate study that found that more than 80% of women reported unawareness that medical students may be performing a pelvic examination on them while they are under anesthesia. 72% of women expect to be asked for permission before an exam under anesthesia, and 62% say that they would provide that consent if they were asked. All patients deserve the right to their bodily autonomy, and imposing an invasive examination on them without their consent violates this right and the trust built between patients and physicians. Currently, Virginia, Texas, New York, Iowa, Maine, and more than 15 other states require informed consent for intimate examinations conducted on anesthetized and unconscious patients. We encourage Minnesota to join the growing number of states that support transparency and informed consent in the medical environment. We ask for your support for SF2846. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? Members have any comments about the bill? Anything you'd like to say? No? Senator McQuaid, this seems like a very reasonable approach and helpful to everybody, the patients and providers. Do you have any final comments about the bill?
No, Madam Chair, I appreciate the committee's time and really all of the stakeholders from the Medical Association to the hospitals to RAIN for just making sure that we can pass a good policy that doesn't harm anybody and helps people.
Thank you. So this bill also needs to go to the Judiciary Committee. Senator Mann moves that Senate File 2846 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail. Senate File 2846 as amended is passed and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Senator Kunesh. Senate File 4001. Welcome to the committees, Senator Kunesh. And I believe that the A1 amendment is an author's amendment. Is that correct? And it's being passed out now. Senator Kunesh, did you wish to adopt the amendment before you start your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to ask for you to adopt the A1 amendment for Senate File 4001.
Thank you. Senator Mann moves that we adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment is adopted. Please proceed and to present your bill.
Thank you so much. Madam Chair and members, the purpose of the bill here is to perform a transparent and independent external analysis of the very complex stream of funding available to Minnesota's child welfare system to better understand and develop opportunities to repurpose, reinvest any additional federal and state funds into preventative services for counties, tribes, and families that need them. For too long, we have relied on our county and tribal partners to carry too big a financial burden for our child protection system. As compared to many other states, Minnesota as a state invests a lower amount into the child welfare system and people impacted by that system. And we rely more heavily on county funding, which has come from county tax dollars and is a heavy, heavy burden on our counties. This bill gives Minnesota an opportunity to gain a more nuanced and complex understanding of available funding, but also provides critical external and independent oversight into how Minnesota is investing and spending its funds in the child welfare system to counties and tribes. This bill will create a working group to support the efforts of the independent external consultant. So it's creating a consultant to do a review. And ultimately, the bill requires both a fiscal analysis, but also a programmatic recommendations and practice model to help Minnesota prioritize prevention services equitably across the state. Many constituent groups and individuals have come together to help draft and support this effort, including DHS, the counties, Leech Lake, and community advocates and service providers. And Madam Chair, that is my bill.
Thank you, Senator. Do you have some testifiers? Ms. Anderson?
Good morning. My name is Kirsten Anderson, and I'm the Executive Director of Aspire Minnesota, a statewide association of child and family serving providers. I'm here to share our support for Senate File 4001. This proposal will deliver analysis and tools that are critical to meet our shared goals for our child welfare and wider child and family service continuum, our top priority being true prevention services to address our painful and persistent overrepresentation of BIPOC children and the wider disparities across the state. Provider organizations understand that achieving child and family well-being is complex and reliant on a variety of supports, including mental health, disability, and contributing social determinants of health. And foundational to child and family well-being is a well-designed child welfare and family preservation system. We lack a clear continuum. We lack a clear continuum because access to care is differentiated by each county or tribe of residents, with significant gaps in what is available to families based on their geographies. Counties and tribes are innovating and delivering exceptional care in many cases, and the scope of learning and impact is often held locally. Minnesota is consistently on the very bottom of national rankings of state investment in child welfare as measured by spending from state general fund. This accounting does not include the significant property tax investments being made statewide, nor does the accounting reflect how Minnesota has utilized TANF, Medicaid, and other strategic investments in critical economic supports to contribute to family preservation. That said, we simply do not know the totality of federal resources that Minnesota has leveraged to support child welfare strategies. We also don't know what federal opportunities Minnesota may be leaving on the table that could be used to fund prevention and early intervention services. We believe Minnesota can build a child and family-centered service continuum that delivers equitable and meaningful care that can respond to our statewide disparities. This study is an asset to meeting that goal. Finally, we appreciate the inclusion of our community-based expert providers in the working group, as our providers hold unique connection with community, and their contributions to these processes are of great value. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Senator Knesh, did you have another testifier you wanted to?
I do.
Please introduce yourself and continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Institute to Transform Child Protection at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. I'm also a professor of law there. Personally and professionally, I want to see Minnesota's child welfare system thrive. For more than 20 years, I've represented parents and relatives in child welfare cases and have also worked on policy reform to preserve family permanence in Minnesota. I'm keenly aware of the need for independent oversight to bring transparency and awareness to what happens within our state agencies. We are a state-supervised and county-administered system that includes 11 sovereign tribal nations and 87 counties. The funding mechanism and framework that allows funding to flow from the federal government to state DHS and then from the state to counties and tribes is a complicated and intricate balance. There are areas where Minnesota may not be capturing funds available or sharing and dispersing them in an equitable way across the state. Also, there are ways that Minnesota could build capacity and knowledge to better invest in preventative services to help children. This bill is critical because it provides a roadmap for Minnesota to first get a baseline analysis of our funding mechanisms, including the critical question about the amount necessary of increased state funding truly needed to support a high-quality system. This bill will also provide a second tier or a scaffolded approach of a practice model and program recommendations to ensure that we are spending money in a way that supports prevention and preventative services to help families and communities from entering our system. Other states have utilized this type of fiscal analysis and program model strategy and have seen very positive results, both in an increase in available funding, but also in more effective practice. There's been a lot of engagement to get to this bill. As Senator Kunesh mentioned, many partners have come together. This has included community partners, agency partners, and tribal partners and county partners. The bill here requires consultation with tribes according to Minnesota policy. It also allows tribal participation. There's an opt-out provision as well, and that's included in the amendment should tribes not want to participate. Tribes are also a part of the decision to choose and elect an external consultant in the current version of the bill. This is an opportunity that Minnesota should lean into. It's an opportunity to assess our fiscal and financial spending in Minnesota and to learn ways that we may be able to do that better. I also just want to point out that the return on investment here is potentially huge in terms of what other states have seen, and I think that's a critical component to this bill as well. But in the end, I would say that this bill is not just about money. At its core, it is a commitment to the thousands of children and families caught up in our child welfare system, and it's a statement to them that we are doing everything we can to ensure access to preventative services and support in all counties and for all families equally. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Woolman. Members' questions? Senator Abler.
Well, thank you. This whole topic is monumental. And welcome to the latest in an effort to try to organize it and get some consensus and redo it. Maybe this will work. I don't know you as well, but I know the other two of you have spent no end of time working on MIFPA and Family First and 16 other pieces of legislation, some of which I've carried, trying to crack this this topic and make it work. There's been a number of task forces, the pendulum swings one way and another, and there's a huge amount of disagreement amongst people who are as dedicated as all of you on what's the best way to do it. So, good luck, I guess. But I just wanted to, it's a fine project, and maybe this is the one, you know? And these really hard things like, if we only had another task force, maybe a blue ribbon task force or something. But I you're bringing this as advocates, and I appreciate that. I wish the department were bringing this. Mm-hmm. I wish they were. We count on them. And, I push on them when I think they need it. The counties, they're trying to survive in this, and there's different outcomes based upon the counties. Is there an effort to find out what county does it the best and use those best practices? Maybe this person will do that. We do have a state-led county, delivered process, and it just seems we're always just nipping around the edges, and maybe this is the comprehensive approach that will really matter. And I appreciate your comment. It's not about the money. But in every one of these conversations, it's, if we can just get a little more federal money. There are $34 trillion in debt, and the very people you're hoping to help are going to be saddled by that somehow. And I used to worry about $8 trillion. I was wrong. I guess $34 trillion is a bigger number. But this is really important, and getting these young people and not so young people on track is really important. The irony, we had there's a task force that's just winding up now that I wasn't part of, which is fine. Now you have a working group to interact with the task force, with the new consultant. So I just want to, as this goes forward and clearly you're talking to people, I wish the success that you hope comes out of this effort. You can get the money, and we'll see. But I guess maybe I'm partly expressing frustration as a person who's led little working groups back in 2017 and others, and people who cared a lot were actually yelling at each other. Mm. People you know, who you like, about what's the best way to do it. And so, just as this goes forward, I would suggest that if there's a state that's done it well, why don't we start with that model as something to kind of work toward, or if there's a county who's quite successful. I remember some time ago there was outcome studies, and we didn't even agree on the metric to measure the outcome, and they were all over the map. Good luck. It's really important, just hope it works. So thank you.
Senator Konecny. Response?
Just that I think you kind of nailed it in a lot of different ways. There have been lots of different attempts to kind of wrap our heads and wrap our pocketbook around this issue. And what I think is really important about what we are proposing here is that we have an independent consultant. The county looks at the issue from their perspective. The legislature looks at it from their perspective. The families and the service providers look at it from their perspective. What we want is somebody that's going to look at it in a very neutral, non-involved way. And do what you said, look at best practices, look at what federal funding we're not drawing down that we have total, we should have total access to, and find ways to really make this work in the best way. And I think that if you look at the list of the 11 members that are on there, it's a good, well-rounded group of folks that will hopefully, as you said, maybe this will be the one that'll help us straighten everything out, and appreciate your support.
Members, other questions? Seeing none, Senator Uckey makes a motion that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. Next up is Senator Kudesh. Senator, do you have an amendment for this?
I do. I have an A1 amendment.
Is it an author's amendment?
Yes, it is.
All right, we'll get that passed out. Members, this is an author's amendment. All those in favor of the A1.
We don't have it
yet. All those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Kunesh, do you have a particular order you want testifiers in, or should we just go down the list?
Just go. I would like Rebecca McConkie Green to be my first testifier, and then after that, whatever you have on your list.
Okay, so Ms. McConkie Green, and then Sherry Goodwin can come down to the testifier table as well. And Ms. McConkie Green, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Just, do you want me to explain the bill?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm really happy to be back here in front of you this morning because we have a little bit more work to do on the Minnesota Family and Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. We worked on this last year and put in protections for our Indigenous families when it came to foster care and adoption outside of the family, because we had concerns about ICWA, the National Indian Family Family Preservation Act, going away. So last year, the tribes in Minnesota, along with organizations that serve American Indian people, brought legislation to ensure that all of the Indian Child Welfare Act was expressly stated in Minnesota law. The legislation passed, but based on the testimony from last year, the tribes realized that while the Indian Child Welfare Act is very important, we need to do better for our Indian people. We formed a large working group which consisted of about 187 people from various legal disciplines, including tribal attorneys, tribal social service directors, MAC, SSA, MCAA, AMC, parent representation, children representation, various organizations that serve Indian families, and areas of the Minnesota State Bar, including the probate section, family law, and domestic violence. There were 10 committees that this broke out into, and this is how we developed the bill SF-4480. There are technical changes in this bill. A lot of it was to reorganize and clean up language to make it not only easier to read, but to update it. There are there's just a lot of cleanup language in there. One of the new things is 260.771 subdivision 2. That's the appointment of counsel for parents, Indian custodians, and Indian children involved in child placement proceedings. And there's a number of things that were updated, clarified, and enforced the spirit of the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. And so with that, I would like to turn it over to Rebecca McConkie-Green, who led this incredible work. I'd like to let her share some of the work that's been done.
Ms. McConkie-Green, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rebecca McConkie-Green. I'm the associate judge for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I've practiced in the area of child protection law during my entire career, so beginning in about 2007, either representing tribes or Indian people in state court and tribal court proceedings. And so this is an area that I have done a great deal of work on, and I'm very honored to have worked on this committee and also to be back this year in front of you. I want to start by thanking you so much last year for the support of making sure that ICWA was fully described in Minnesota law. Tribes were frankly terrified last year when we were here because we were afraid of what was going to happen with the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and Minnesota really strongly supported the tribes and the importance of that law. But as you were hearing testimony from the tribal people and tribal leaders that were here, we realized that as important as that law is to us, there is way more that we need to do. We still have families suffering much large disparities in out-of-home placement and still just in general suffering, and we need to do better for the families. So we immediately started working, and we've really appreciated the people that participated. The county attorneys not only showed up, they actually helped lead a number of the work groups, which was great. We had MAXA people, which is social service directors, that did the same thing. And AMC, which is the elected county folks, were also coming to things and weighing in, and that was wonderful. And as Senator Kunisch described, we had quite a number of other people participating too. Sometimes coming to meetings a lot, but also sometimes just advising us when we needed help and phone calls, and we truly appreciate all of that. To tell you a little bit about the changes, a lot of it is cleanup language. One of the things that's really important to understand is that we tend to think of MIFBA and the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, as applying to child protection. But in fact, it actually applies to any time a child, an Indian child, is removed from the care and custody of their parents and can't be returned simply by the parent asking, okay? So that implicates, it does not implicate custody decision between parents or juvenile delinquency proceedings. But it does implicate things like probate, and it implicates things like third party and de facto custodian proceedings, voluntary placements for care, and a number of other areas. We haven't in Minnesota done a very good job in the past of making sure that all of those protections were easy to access. So one of the things that we did is in most sections where it applies, we made sure that there was language notifying people that the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act apply to those proceedings so that people know and can follow those laws. We also did some things last year when we were putting all of the language together. Some of the sections as far as notice provisions and active efforts got a little bit messy, so we cleaned those up so that they're easier to read and easier to follow. We clarified jurisdiction. We clarified some language about transfer to tribal court and the good cause to deny transfer. And we added a stronger language about complying with placement preferences during emergency removals. One of the things that we did as well was because this law applies to things like third-party custody and probate, we don't have currently in Minnesota law the ability and the requirement to appoint counsel to parents, Indian custodians, and children, even though that's required by federal law. The federal law was passed in 1978, so we are very significantly behind in getting that done, and we have that in this bill, so that now there will be provisions to provide for court-appointed counsel for parents, children, Indian children, Indian custodians when they don't have the financial means to provide their own counsel. Let's see. We also provided some improvements for tribal participation. It's important to remember that tribes that are appearing in any of these types of proceedings in Minnesota may be from anywhere in the country. Unfortunately, the history of the United States interactions with tribes meant that tribal people were dispersed throughout the United States during the termination and relocation era. So it's important that they be able to participate in their hearings if they have tribal members in Minnesota. And most tribes do have people all over the United States. So we have language about making sure that they can appear by phone or electronically, which is not something that should not be problematic after coming through the pandemic when we were utilizing Zoom so much. We also have some provisions that allow tribal reps to appear who are not attorneys that are licensed in Minnesota and to not pay filing fees and to not have to use the e-file system. All of these provisions were already available for people participating in Minnesota child protection. But again, because this law applies to more than child protection, we needed to make sure we had language so that tribes and Indian people outside of the state can participate as well. Let's see. We have some language extending the permanency filing deadlines to match the federal requirements instead of the current state requirement. Right now in Minnesota, there is a requirement to have a permanency hearing at 12 months, and the federal standard is 15 months, and so we're asking to expand and include that. And then I think I'll stop there and allow further testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sherry Goodman.
Bonjour, good morning, everybody. Madam Chair, Senate Committee, my name is Sherry Goodwin. I oversee Obamendog Adonaway Manidug, which means uplifting all of our relatives. I'm from Red Lake Nation. I'm here to be talking about the foster care provision, and just to let you all know that from our realm, from a Native American realm, is foster care, their providers. In our language, they're the ones who's watching over our little ones, and they really have a temporary role. So the goal is reunification all the time. So right now we're really focusing on that by decolonizing some of our practices. And again, I want to thank all of you for the support for the American Indian Child Welfare System Initiative Tribe. That's what we are. We're the blue ribbon over there, Senator Abler. Just kidding. But the gold standard is ICWA. And the future is that that gold standard should be applied to all children in Minnesota, not just Native Americans. So again, foster care has a temporary role while parents are seeking help in the areas that interfere with their ability to care in healthy ways. We need access to services. Our access to services are often limited to causing our children to be in the foster care system for longer durations. We have made a shift from protecting children from their families to protecting the whole family at the same time, understanding the temporary role of foster care providers here in the process. Child welfare currently operates in the idea of personal agency, which ignores the historical impact on American Indian families. Personal agency puts all the responsibility on the parent, yet there are known systemic barriers that lead to negative outcomes. The proposed changes gets us in a better position to set up our families to stay together. So I just want to thank you again for listening to us and for really being support of Native Americans here in Minnesota, because it's a big deal, and I feel that us as American Indian Child Welfare Initiative are really changing the face. And right now we are investing in our kids, because we know that these permanency timelines, we know when these research shows when these kids turn 18, no matter who they are in the whole United States, they're right back there looking for their parents. And I believe by investing in the parents and the families now, we'll end up saving the state and federal, our federal system's money, because when they stay in the system till they're 18, that's just costing us more money. So if we invest now, with some of the proposals Senator Kunesh and her team bring forward, I believe that's the future, because the ultimate goal is to keep the families together. So miigwech for listening to me today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Goodwin. Ms. Lori York. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Lori York, and I'm the White Earth Nation Executive Director and the American Indian Child Welfare ICWA Advisory Council Co-Chair. Thank you very much for your time today. So as you've heard earlier today, we've had a lot of folks working on MIFBA, and last year we were very terrified of what that ICWA outcome may become or may be. So we did our best to codify the language to ensure that MIFBA could be a standalone in the event that ICWA was taken down. So today, the bill that is brought forward today ensures greater protections for Indian children, their families, and tribes in the following ways. This legislation provides many practice improvements, including inserts language into several areas of the law where ICWA and MIFBA apply, but were often overlooked. It provides a mechanism for appointment of counsel to parents, Indian custodians, and Indian children in areas of law where counsel is not already provided for them. It clarifies notice provisions and improves access for tribes to ensure tribes are able to provide input to the petitioners and the courts about what is truly the best interest of the children. It expands permanency timelines from 12 to 15 months and allows for extensions of those timelines under limited circumstances to ensure that the Indian children are safe when returned to their parents and Indian custodians. It allows for courts to award costs and sanctions where appropriate when the court has invalidated proceedings based on violations of the law. You have received letters of supports and resolutions from Fond du Lac, Upper Sioux, Leech Lake, White Earth, the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. Today, White Earth Nation, along with American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council, supports Senate File 4480. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. York. We're going to move to some Zoom testifiers. Chairman Kevin Dupuis. He's not. So we're going to move to President Robert Larson.
Mahal, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you allowing me to testify from home. I'm still in recovery after a surgery. So with that, I'm Robert Larson, president of the Lower Sioux Indian Community, also chair the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Preservation of ICWA and strengthening of MIFBA is of ongoing and critical importance for the Lower Sioux Indian community in the state of Minnesota. Prior to the passage of ICWA in 1978, Indian children were placed in foster care in adoptive homes at a rate of 19 times higher than that of non-Indian children. And in some states, 85% of all Indian children were placed in non-Indian homes. In 2020, Indian children in our state were 16.4% more likely than white children to be placed out of home. As foster parents ourselves, my wife and I know and live the importance of ICWA and now MIFBA, as we've been foster parents and ultimately have adopted two of our children. So I thank you for the work that you've done. There's still work to go, as you've heard. Senate File 4480, authored by Senator Kunesh, amends MIFBA to specifically further compliance, clarifies and deconflicts statutory language, strengthens existing provisions, clarifies the role of foster parents in MIFBA proceedings, and provides remedies and consequences in cases which invalidation occurs. The community fully supports the amendments as provided in Senate File 4480 and appreciates passage of this bill to ensure MIFBA is strengthened and better serves the needs of Indian children and families. I want to say Padamia and Wopita Tonka to all your work that you've done today and that you continue to do, and everyone that's done this, thank you for your time. Padamia.
Thank you. We're going to move to Aaron Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Aaron Johnson. I am an assistant Washington County attorney. I've been at Washington County for 20 years. practicing in the child protection arena for the majority of that time. I also work with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association on their juvenile law committee, specifically on areas related to legislation and policy for child protection issues. I want to start by acknowledging the appreciation that the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has for being invited to be a part of this, quite honestly, massive undertaking. We also want to acknowledge that this is a tribally led bill. It was the Minnesota tribes who recognized with the U.S. Supreme Court case last year the need to strengthen Minnesota laws, and it was the Minnesota tribes who brought a large group of stakeholders together to do that work. I also wanted to highlight Ms. Rebecca McConkie Green, as she was really the point person for all of this, and being a lawyer myself, know what it's like to herd more than one lawyer. The whole herding cats concept definitely came in with this process. So I wanted to acknowledge her work. Again, we've been very appreciative to be a part of these discussions, the ongoing conversations to strengthen what we need to do for Indian children and families in the state of Minnesota. And we also recognize that historically those conversations have been led by the state or counties. And in this case, it was led by the tribes. So we want to very much acknowledge that fact, and why we're here today is because of the tribes. Overall, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association does support Senate file number 4480. There are a few areas, however, where we do have concerns. Those areas are highlighted in more detail in a letter that the Minnesota County Attorneys Association has submitted to the committee for your review. But the areas I will just highlight really relate to limitations put on the judiciary and some prohibitions put into law that didn't currently exist. One of the concerns that the County Attorneys Association does have is the prohibition of foster parents from being able to intervene in proceedings. We understand the reasoning, especially in light of the Brackeen case, for why the tribes would like that limitation, but our concern is that there is currently a right that exists in Minnesota law for foster parents to intervene in proceedings. The court already has the ability to determine if they should or should not. It's a permissive intervention. We do not believe that an overall prohibition removing that right is best for children and families. County Attorneys Association are also concerned about the limitations put on a court's ability to determine who should appear in person or virtually. We absolutely support the idea that tribes, as well as ICWA guardian ad litem, should have the ability to appear virtually or by phone. However, when it comes to parents or custodians, it is crucial that a court has the ability to determine that they should be in person rather than virtually. Of primary concern for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association as well is the expansion of the permanency timelines. Not because we necessarily disagree that that conversation needs to occur, but rather that it's a complex, large-scale change that we are asking to do. It applies not just to MIFBA and Indian children, but it will apply across the board to all children, all families who come into our child welfare system. One of the concerns of the County Attorneys Association is that this change was primarily discussed in the context of the MIFBA working group. And while all of those people there were very much committed to child welfare, not just for Native families, but for families as a whole, we believe that there needs to be a wider net cast in order to make sure all people who will be affected by this, including those with lived experience in the system, have a voice. This change affects a number of statutes. It is also affecting or will affect the rules of juvenile protection procedure. So it's not a simple fix. And I appreciate some of the comments that have been made about the complexity of the system. And it is complex, and part of that exists because of our statutory system that we operate under. It is a conflicting, confusing set of statutes that we are set to abide by. And any large-scale change such as changing the permanency timeline, needs to be done with a fine-tooth comb, with an eye to making sure that we're not creating additional conflicts, additional confusion. So while the County Attorneys Association definitely supports having that conversation, we do think more work needs to be done to understand and make sure that all of the necessary changes are made in the law, both in the statute and potentially in the rules. We also need to make sure that we have a full understanding of the impact this will have on practice and the resources that it may come along with, the possibility of extending foster care time, continuing cases for an additional length of time. Ultimately, overall, as I indicated, we are in support of Senate file number 4480, with the exception of those few areas. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We will continue to work with the tribes and all of the stakeholders, and if there's any questions, I'm available to answer those. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. We'll move back to Zoom. Ms. Julie Hansen. Ms. Hansen, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Julie Hansen, and I'm the Director of Social Services in Monoman County. And today I'm representing MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. Monoma County has the unique claim of being the only county completely enclosed on a reservation, which would be White Earth Nation, and has the highest poverty rate in the state of Minnesota. Being included in the tribally led work group to strengthen MIFPA is very much appreciated. This process allowed for voices of various partners to be heard and education of other perspectives and experiences in a lot of areas. MACSA is invested in upholding the spirit of ICWA and supporting MIFPA, ensuring best interests and safety of children and addressing fiscal impacts and needs. MACSA understands the tremendous disparities that exist in the social services system and has a strong desire to address those issues wherever possible. The bill before you is an example of various partners across the state working together to address the issues that face Native American families and children in the child welfare system. MACSA agrees with and supports the changes before you today. However, there are a few areas of concerns I would like to address. MACSA agrees with the MCAA testimony that was just provided. County attorneys and social service agencies work hand in hand in child welfare services and rely on each other to understand and interpret the myriad of systems, rules, and statutes that we must navigate every day. Regarding the permanency timelines, we're in agreement that they may no longer be appropriate, and MACSA supports the county attorney's testimony and the request for this system to be reviewed as a whole, as there could be grave impacts to families as well as fiscal and staffing impacts to counties and states. Providing active efforts to extended family members is most definitely within the spirit of ICWA, and MACSA and social service agencies across the state would very much like to be able to offer active efforts to extended families also. If every family could be provided with all the support and resources that they need to meet the very real needs that are in existence today, the need for out-of-home placement could be drastically reduced. But the reality is that active efforts require resourcing in the form of staff, community resources, and technology. A majority of things that are considered active efforts are resourced by local levy dollars. As you heard in Senate File 4001, all counties and tribes are under financial stress to provide protective services. Small and rural counties, such as Monoman, do not have the community resources or the tax base to fund active efforts as we wish they could be. It is also very apparent in many comments and testimony that you have or will hear is the technology systems that are in existence do not meet the needs of our state. Staffing capacity at all state and county levels is at a breaking point, and many resources that are needed to provide active efforts and services to families and Native American families is just not available outside the metro areas of the state. Again, MACSA supports preserving the integrity of ICWA and MIFPA while prioritizing child safety and the best interests of the Indian child. These changes need to be made with thought to safety and systemic and fiscal impact. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. That's all we have on the list today, but is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify? With that, members' questions and comments. Senator Abler.
Well, on the last bill, Senator Kunesh, if you thought that little consultant project's gonna be so simple, look at this, which is a subset of that. And mm-hmm. so for the students watching at home on their master's thesis, there you go, I think you've got a project. Thank you for your work on this. I've supported all along the efforts to help our tribal children, and the disparities in out-of-home placements and in terminations is incredibly disparate with both this and the African-American children. I'm not qualified to comment on most of the bill, but I just wanted to highlight the concerns the county attorneys had. And last year, I have another question, and I'll go to the ones they mentioned today. There was a concern about the threshold that I mentioned to you, Senator Kunesh, Brad Johnson from Maya County was fearful that if there was a case where they thought the child really was in peril, that they had to charge the parent criminally in order to make it stick because the threshold was so high. Did you figure that out, whatever fix there was to that in this bill?
Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask Ms. McConkie-Green to, she knows this bill very intimately and would know that detail.
Ms. McConkie-Green.
Thank you. I think what you're referring to is something that passed last year, which was a definition for imminent physical damage and harm. Yeah. And we're not willing to bend off of that. I want to assure you that tribes certainly value their children very much, but I don't agree with the proposition that a parent would actually have to be charged in order to move forward. The Indian Child Welfare Act makes very clear that in an emergency situation, act to protect the child. We are requiring through that definition that the child actually really be in danger, but if the child is in danger, the county can act to protect the child. Right. Otherwise, the county can act to protect the child as long as they have worked with the tribe and have the tribe's support in the form of qualified expert witness testimony to remove the child. But there is no provision and no circumstance that would allow arrest of a parent isn't going to change those analysis, I guess. And so yeah. I don't know if that helps or if there's a further question on that.
Well, Senator Abler.
Madam Chair, and so... I don't hold myself out as an expert. I'm just relating the concern of my county, and we had a meeting about that, and they were really quite concerned that in all these discussions, you spent a career in this. The testifier, Ms. Johnson, has a career in this. It's ironic that people like me have to decide, and I know I've been in more meetings than many of my colleagues, and so it's... But here we are, we trust the testifiers and we try to just shape you along. So I'm just really repeating what they told me. And they weren't trying to take kids away, but there's times when the system doesn't work. So it seems that the county attorneys and MACSA are the ones that pick up the pieces when the MIFPA ICWA system didn't provide what it was to do. And you're trying to make it so it's more solid I favor tribes first. I'm all on board with that in my, limited knowledge that I have. Is this bill gonna move to judiciary or somewhere? All right, so a lot of the concerns can be handled there, but and to the two of you, I presume that you've taken the concerns of the, are there any concerns of the, I'll ask you this way. You've heard their concerns. Can you just tell me what you think about, like you're not worried about what I mentioned, you're not going to do anything about it. So thank you for at least, I'll just tell my guy that and he can lose sleep over it. On the enumerated list there, would you mind just help for the sake of, you saw their letter, I don't need it. Just like the first thing, we think we should work on that one.
Sure,
and in particular, the effect on the other systems, which are not related to MIFPA and ICWA, that must be on your mind. You don't intend to change current practice for non-tribal cases, right?
Ms. McConkie-Green.
Okay, thank you. So if I can just kind of go down the list of notes that I took and responded. I want to start first with apologizing if I came across a little bit too harshly with your first question. I understand that that question causes a lot of angst for people. I would encourage them always to work with the tribes in their areas. From the tribal perspective, what we were seeing is kids removed on an emergency basis for things like truancy and things that are not dangerous to the child. And we're trying to make sure that we limit out-of-home placement of children where we can, right? So going down your list, one of the things that they brought up was foster parent intervention. And, you know, Ms. Goodwin testified today because we do want you to understand that tribes appreciate foster parents, and there are quite a number of tribal leaders and tribal professionals that are themselves foster parents. Indian children do have to be placed out of home at times, and we really value that placement. However, there is a growing trend across the United States, and there's an article that I can provide that where the foster parents are intervening in child protection cases very early in proceedings, often sometimes as early as 4 months into the case, and then competing with the parents for placement of that child at the end of the case. That is not appropriate in an ICWA case because of the requirements for active efforts. And I guess I personally question whether it's ever appropriate. In the state of Minnesota, people can intervene as parties to a case, or they can be participants to the case, or there's just the public, right? Minnesota law and Minnesota rules list foster parents already as participants to cases, and we're not trying to do anything with that. When someone is a participant to a case, they can come to court, they get notices of hearings, they can talk to the judge will call on them and ask for their opinions on things, and they can get information about the child that they're caring for. What they can't do as participants and what they could do if they are made parties is they can bring motions, they can file petitions, they can get discovery about the parents, and they can litigate with the parents for custody of the child. This particular article talks about the fact that when this happens, it greatly expands the amount of time the case is before the court. And it really is stressful and difficult for the parents to deal with. Sometimes these are motions to restrict the parents' ability to visit with their own child or to restrict placement of the child back with the parent. And I question whether this should happen in any child protection case in Minnesota. But under the Indian Child Welfare Act, there is a requirement to provide active efforts towards reunification. And allowing intervention of foster parents would directly contravene that and would complicate it greatly. And so we understand, you know, again, we value foster parents. We want them to be heard. We don't want to have them competing with the parents. With the virtual appearance issue and the fact that we're asking for tribes to appear virtually, I think I touched on briefly at the beginning the kind of difficult history between the United States government and the state of Minnesota and Indian tribes, and including the fact that all of the tribes in Minnesota have Indian tribal members that are all over the United States, and likewise for pretty much every tribe in the United States has members all over, including in Minnesota. Indian families are much more closely knit, and it is very important that they be able to participate in hearings, and it is very important that the tribe be able to participate in hearings. And that is difficult. And so for child protection right now, we have things like that the tribe doesn't have to have an attorney licensed in Minnesota to appear, and we're expanding that to anywhere that child protection occurs. We also want to make sure that they can participate. We don't want tribes that are in California or Oklahoma or there's a tribe in Texas, but other parts of the United States, to have to fly here every time there's a hearing and appear. And so what we're asking to do is to allow them to appear electronically. I would point out to you that the BIA regulations, and I don't know if I do have this handy. The Bureau of Indian Affairs promulgated some regulations, I believe, in 2016, and that is binding authority on the states. And Regulation 23.133 states that courts should allow alternative methods of participation for hearings where they can. Certainly, you know, this was done, of course, several years before the pandemic, and at that point in time in Minnesota, we had already passed something allowing tribes to appear by phone, and sometimes we were all gathered up at the bench so that we could all be heard over the phone. But then we had the pandemic, and now state courts are still using Zoom a lot on many types of hearings, including child protection. So there isn't a barrier to the state providing the service, and it would greatly improve participation of outstate tribes. Then on the expansion of timelines, so we've tried to do a pretty thorough review of the statute, and we are consulting in the process of consulting with the Department of Human Services and getting technical assistance, and they know far more about this than we do, and we certainly acknowledge that they are going through the statutes and our provisions with a fine-tooth comb. And we've had some pretty good discussions about that, and we expect to get that technical assistance back soon. The expansion of timelines is really important to us and is something that we've been talking to people about for years. And I would like to note that in the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which is where these timelines come from, they also talk about chemical dependency and about the need to evaluate how badly that is impacting systems. And I don't remember what year that passed, but that was quite a while ago. We are continuing to have those struggles. And frankly, Minnesota, you know, the federal timeline is 15 months. Or when certain really bad things have happened. And we are not trying to change if bad things have happened, file the petition. And by bad things, I mean murder of a child or serious harm of a child. We want permanency petitions to go ahead and be filed, and we're not changing anything with that. What we are asking to change is instead of filing a permanency petition at 12 months or having the first hearing at 12 months, we want that to follow the federal timeline of 15 months. And that's because the cases that we are facing are largely either substance abuse-based or mental health-based. We don't have a full picture at 12 months to be confident that things are going to be good at that point in many cases. And so we want that extra time. We think that will create better reunification for people and more safety for children because we can watch the situation. We are also asking to be able to expand those timelines at times. That is allowed under the federal law under certain findings, and we are following those findings. Because again, if one of those, for example, is that the child is placed with a family member, I don't think we need to worry about some of the concerns that happens about permanency for children when children are placed with their family, especially for Indian families. We are asking for all of these things for all kids in Minnesota, and that's because often in child protection cases, including ICWA and MIFPA cases, we have siblings of the child that are not tribal members. And so we want to make sure that we're not running into competing timelines because there's one set for children who aren't considered Indian children under the law and another for kids that are Indian children. We want to make sure this is consistent for families across the board. So those were the things that Erin highlighted out of her letters.
Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And if nothing else, this helps illustrate the complexity of this and the importance of it, seriously. And so I support the direction you're going. I'm going to, you know, vote in favor of the bill. I'm not an obstacle to improving this. But if I have a role at all in my situation, it's just to keep pushing people back into the room together to make sure that the best possible outcome can come. And it seems like the more voices that go on, it gets crafted a little more, you know, finely. And I think the topic, there's a single thing that I just want to, that jumped out to me in the testimony was the influence on a totally non-tribal case as a result of this tribal effort, MIFPA, ICWA, you know, and all that. You know, if there's a sibling who's connected, that's a different than a non-connected at all sibling. So I don't even know how to parse that, but just so Senator Kunesh, I appreciate your work on this. It's really, really important, and my comments are meant to only be encouraging it to work as well as that you all hoped. And I'm impressed with the level of technical knowledge on all the testifiers, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's off the judiciary, and good luck with that one. So thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the time.
Other questions? Senator Uckey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will be real brief because of the fact of where it's stopping next. We're going to let them do the work. But I did have concerns in the bill, but you know, the county attorneys highlighted some of their concerns. And there's a number of places in here giving direction to the courts. And with that, I'm not going to go any further because our colleagues from Judiciary will, I'm sure, have plenty of questions for you, and we'll let them shake that out. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Members, questions? Did we have another testifier online? Nope. Okay. So with that, Senator Bolden, would you like to make a motion that the bill be recommended as amended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion passes. And with that, members, we are adjourned.